Hello, this is Frank Falvey with Frank's Musings. And on the top of the agenda again today is Gaza. Just as a recap, on October 7th in 2000, I believe 23, October 7th of 2023, the Palestinians, Hamas, attacked a settlement and music festival in the West Bank, killing, capturing or killing 1,500 individuals. The attack was condemned by the world as a terrorist attack. And the Prime Minister of Israel, Netanyahu, declared war on the West, on Gaza, and the terrorist Hamas, and he meant it. He meant that he was going to wipe them out. He meant that every building was going to be destroyed, and he certainly had the power to do that. He certainly had the overwhelming military force. There was no question about the ability to do that. And he proceeded to bomb every building, hospital, killing a lot of innocent civilians. Now, the Hamas attack, in my opinion, was only to start a wider and broader war. They wanted a major Middle East conflict in which Iran would be part of. Well, that never happened. Iran has never, ever escalated the conflict beyond what Netanyahu has done. To me, this was purposely a plan of the right-wing state government of Israel to destroy completely Gaza, and to occupy it and to have it under Israel control. I've always believed from the beginning that their action was genocide. Let me read a paper. I'm a genocide scholar. I know it when I see it. By Omar Barreto, a professor at Brown University. I'm a genocide scholar. I know it when I see it. By Omar Barreto. He is a professor at Brown University. A month after the Hamas attack on Israel on October 7th, 2023, I believe there was evidence that the Israel military had committed war crimes and potentially crimes against humanity in its counterattack on Gaza. But contrary to the cries of Israel's fiercest critics, the evidence did not seem to me to rise to the crime of genocide. By May 2024, the Israel Defense Force had ordered about 1 million Palestinian sheltering in Rafah, the southernmost and last remaining relatively undamaged city of the Gaza Strip, to move to the beach area of the Mawasi, where there was little to no shelter. The army then proceeded to destroy much of Rafah, a feat mostly accomplished by August. At that point, it appeared no longer possible to deny that the patterns of the IDF which is the Israel Defense Force. I will be mentioning the IDF a number of times. Operation was consistent with the statements denoting genocide intent made by Israel leaders in the days after the Hamas attack. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had promised that the enemy would pay a huge price for the attack and that the IDF would turn parts of Gaza, where Hamas was operating, into rubble. He called on the citizens of Gaza to leave now because we will operate forcefully everywhere. My inescapable conclusion has become that Israel is committing genocide against the Palestinian people. Having grown up in a Zionist home, lived the first half of my life in Israel, served in the IDF as a soldier and officer, and spent most of my career researching and writing on war crimes in the Holocaust, this was a painful conclusion to reach, and one that I resisted as long as I could, but have been teaching classes on genocide for a quarter of a century. I can recognize one when I see it. This is not just my conclusion. A growing number of experts in genocide studies and international law have concluded that Israel's action in genocide can only be defined as genocide. So has Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur for the West Bank in Gaza, and Amnesty International South Africa has brought a genocide case against Israel at the International Court of Justice. The crime of genocide was defined in 1948 by the United Nations as the intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group, as such in determining what constitutes genocide. Therefore, we must both establish intent and show that it is being carried out. In Israel's case, that intent has been publicly expressed by numerous officials and leaders. But the intent can also be derived from a pattern of operations on the ground, and a pattern became clear by May 2024 and has since become ever clearer as the IDF has systematically destroyed the Gaza Strip. According to recent investigation by Haaretz, an estimated 174,000 buildings have been destroyed or damaged, accounting for up to 70% of all structures. This piece was written in April. So far, more than 58,000 people have been killed. It's now well over 65,000. According to Gaza health authorities, including more than 17,000 children, who made up nearly a third of the total fatality count, more than 870 of those children were less than a year old. More than 2,000 families have been wiped out, the health authority said, in addition to 5,800 families, now count only one survivor. At least 10,000 people are believed to be still buried under their homes. More than 138,000 have been wounded and maimed. Some might describe this campaign as ethnic cleansing, not genocide, but there is a link between the crimes. When an ethnic group has nowhere to go and is constantly displaced from one so-called safe zone to another relentlessly bombed and starved, ethnic cleansing can morph into genocide. The coupling of the genocide charge with the deliberate killing of children, images of whom are ubiquitous on NGO, social media, and other platforms that charge Israel with genocide. In other words, showing images of Palestinian children ripped apart by US-made bombs launched by Israel pilots is, in this view, an anti-Semitic act. Growing numbers of rabbis and of other countries around the world have recognized not only that this is genocide, but the whole humanitarian way that Israel has carried out this one-sided war is to intimidate and kill civilians. The Netanyahu government and the Israel government is clearly using scare tactics normally used by Russia to intimidate and wipe out civilians. I mean, they've killed Americans. They've killed 220 journalists. They have no mercy. They stopped food trucks from the beginning. They have had no way of helping the civilian population survive. Yes, I've seen news clips of children trying to get some liquid, something that looked fairly healthy. But then I've seen on the news just children starving to death, just skin and bones. And even older people, you know, not over the years, just wasting away. And it has got to be starvation, the fear of moving from one place to the other, has got to be wrecking the mental capacity of those individuals living in Gaza. Biden, Trump, have only been patsies of the Netanyahu government. They have had no backbone in standing up. They have permitted U.S. military ordinances to fall on civilian people and claim that there might be a tunnel under that building, or there might be an armed Palestinian or Hamas fighter in the building. They're just blanketing. They're just indiscriminately want to get rid of the people in Gaza. They're recommending they go to the South Sudan. Not a nice place at all. They want to take over and run the Gaza Strip. Our government has been wholly participating in what the Netanyahu government wants with no willy-nilly. They just accept and ship the armaments. It is both Biden and Trump, okay, who have had no plan at all to stop this war or to perfect and protect the civilians. You know, I think it was the Biden administration spent $430 million trying to build a ramp so they could unload stuff from a ship and have it land on Gaza soil without a U.S. troop being involved on land. It was a complete failure. They had to stop the operation almost as soon as they start. They have not considered having UN or other forces protect trucks and food shipments from Egypt or other places to go in to provide humanitarian aid. We have been totally, as an executive branch, ineffective. We have, as citizens, looked the other way. There is only one organization in Boston, Mass, that actively fights and asks people to write their representatives to stop offensive weapons and to stop sending aid, military aid, to Israel. One of the political problems seems to be that, yes, we have a huge religious Jewish population that has contributed mightily to the United States in the formation and structure and the operation of the U.S. government, and also supported Israel in the early age of the country and still supports it now. And we have a tiny, tiny Palestinian representation within this country. And that imbalance has, I believe, influenced how we treat the Netanyahu government. We should treat this as an outlaw government that is not solving anything for the future, because at some time long after I'm gone, the Palestinians will have the upper hand, history will change, and Israel will be the worst from its position now. I can't express how upset I am that we are having children bombing. You know, the Hamas government doesn't care about its citizens. You know, don't get it wrong that the terrorists have any sympathy for their people. They don't. They just want to eradicate Israel. They just want them off the planet. And as far as Israel in World War II and the Holocaust, we have a Holocaust museum in Washington, D.C. Will we have a Palestinian Gaza museum next to it in some future years, showing the genocide that a country that has experienced the Holocaust will perpetrate genocide on another country? Yeah. We need immediately to rethink our policy. Trump is completely ineffective as a diplomat, as a president. on this issue, he should take a stronger stand and not be sending military aid. But number one, he should have humanitarian food and a corridor and ways that the people today can get not 100 trucks, but 600 trucks a day that they need to bring them off the brink of starvation. I want to talk about Ukraine. You know, Russia invaded Ukraine. Russia was the aggressor. Russia had done it before, and apparently it will do it again if there was ever a ceasefire. Russia has gone all out in its military. The Biden administration failed immediately to recognize the problem and failed immediately to send the necessary equipment, arms, supplies, resupplies, and it took a long time. The Trump and Republican administration have never clearly been on the Ukrainian side. Trump has failed as a diplomat to provide a solution to Ukraine. He has been waffling is maybe a good word, you know, or a bobblehead. Putin is my friend. Yeah, Putin is my friend. No, Putin is not my friend. Putin is not doing what I want. Zelensky is my friend. Yeah, Zelensky is my friend. Oh, he's a great guy. Zelensky, he knows what he's... Zelensky's got to give up territory. He's got to give up territory. He's got to... He has to... he's got to give up to, he's got to make concessions. He's a bobblehead. You know, I see he was watching the U.S. tennis, he was president at the men's final for the U.S. tennis. It's like, you know, in 1 minute, he's in Zelensky's court. You know, he watched the ball, then as at 124 miles an hour, the ball's in the other court, and he's in the other court. Oh no, Putin is right, Putin is right. He has dumped the problem on Europe, and Europe has raised and come to the answer. You know, they have stepped forward. Do you know, I learned the other day that there's 70,000 women in the army in Ukraine, all volunteers, and most of them, I gather, are on the front line. The Ukrainian citizens are just like the revolutionary citizens that we're going to celebrate next year in America. They want their country. They will go to death and fight for their country. They're not going to put up with the invasion. They showed at the beginning, if they had more resources, they probably would have driven the Russians back to the sea. They've blown up ships, they've blown up airplanes, they bombed Moscow, and, you know, they have done everything that citizens of a country that want that country to stay and be their homeland. It is demonstrated to me the character of Ukraine by what they have done. and how they have fought and how they still are fighting. And it has shown the character of President Trump that he don't know what he's doing. He brings Putin back from not being on the world stage to the world stage. He greets him on the red carpet. They have a conversation. Putin apparently agrees to some items. And then it's not the next day that Russia launches the second worst attack on Ukraine and are continuing to attack every single day. The Ukrainian, not only military, but civilian life, the life of electricity, the life of operating, the life of living and being able to sleep at night without worrying about your apartment or building getting bombed up, bombed to pieces. Ukraine needs our help. I remember immediately after this war started, the Interfaith Council invited one of the Ukrainian priests. There are two Ukrainian churches in Woonsocket. One is an Orthodox church, Ukrainian Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox, and one is a Roman Catholic Ukrainian church. The priest from the Roman Catholic Church came and spoke on our common. I would love to have the Interfaith Council bring that priest back and speak to us on humanitarian issues and what's happening in Ukraine. The Trump administration, okay, seems only in how much money they can get from Ukraine. How much money can Ukraine pay the United States for the weapons? Trump doesn't seem to realize the seriousness of this incursion on neighbors of NATO. And even NATO has had it attacked. We need to be more forceful in that attack. Trump has offered a new sanctions proposal, but he wants Europe to stop buying Russian oil. Let's consider that. Where would Europe get enough oil at a price that wouldn't break them? I mean, if they buy oil anywhere, the price is going to be higher. But the question of whether they can buy enough oil anywhere is a serious question, along with the practice of distribution. Can you distribute oil that you import to the citizens of your country during the harsh winters that particularly happened in Europe and in England? It is an impossible request. It's not practical. Of course, Trump isn't practical, but, you know, so why should you expect his proposals to be practical? It is not a practical solution. I want to thank the British government for making come true one of Trump's fantasies. It was a beautiful carriage ride, a beautiful military honor ride through the countryside into Windsor Castle, and for Trump and Melania to stay overnight at Windsor Castle. I thank the British government for filling that fantasy that Trump had. It was a generous, beyond necessary gratefulness of the British government. And apparently he and the King have known one another for quite a while, going back a number of years. And if you saw the banquet, I don't know, there must have been 100 people at that banquet table in that hall. I could not believe my eyes. And so the British government and the European government is trying to at least have Trump stay neutral and, trying to have the Trump administration support the Ukrainian government, which it morally and rightfully could. Again, we go back to the fact that, yes, in Woonsocket there is a Ukrainian community, but that community and the community in the United States is fairly small and not that large and significant. And that means they don't have as much political power as other parts are happening. Ukraine needs our support. We need to change our policy and wholeheartedly ship offensive weapons from Gaza to Ukraine. Ukraine needs the weapons. Israel does not. We need to be prepared to honor our commitment to NATO and not to leave NATO and Europe hanging by itself. There is no logic and there is no sense in that happening. Well, to go on from Ukraine, tariffs. Tariffs are a national sales tax. New Hampshire doesn't have a sales tax. New Hampshire has no sales tax. Republicans hate, Republicans love sales tax because it puts more of the burden on individual of low income and helps lessen the burden of those with higher income. But no one wants a sales tax. No one likes a sales tax. We have one in Massachusetts of 6.2%, I believe it is. No, 6.2%. But Trump is going to impose on some items nationally a 50% sales tax, a 10 to 50%, or maybe even higher in some cases, sales tax. Recognize it. It is you and I and American citizens that are going to pay for this tax. It is not the country that is shipping the item. It is you, the buyer, the consumer. Now, Trump hopes, that the sales tax is going to encourage industries. Well, Farik Sarad, who was a TV commentator on Sunday mornings, did an hour-long program on tariffs, which if you can go back and see somehow, and pointed out that tariffs led to the Great Recession and how ineffective tariffs were. One of the things that Trump said he would use the money from tariffs for was to pay down the debt. Ain't gonna happen, people. Trump has recently announced the rebuilding or renovation of the Kennedy Center. He's going to use tariffs. He's going to build a ballroom, which he said he's going to use his own personal money, on the grounds of the White House. Trump is going to make Washington, D.C. a city of buildings or statues, and he's going to spend more money for those in a wealthier bracket. He's already done that with his big, beautiful bill. He has made cryptocurrency, you know, his $5 billion so far automatic new wealth. And he's going to spend $250 million to build a ballroom on the grounds of the White House. He is not going to lower the debt, which is the number one priority that he has to do. The debt needs to come down. And you see how he's going to make the debt come down? He's going to have a sales tax, a national sales tax on the items that you and I are going to have to buy or need to buy, maybe because we're not making them here in America. And maybe, even with a 50% tax, no one is going to make them in America. No one is going to make a manufacturing plant in America to make that item, including medicine. Now, medicine, in my opinion, should be made here. Computer chips, in my opinion, absolutely need to be made here. There are some things that in World War II were called items of national defense. You can't have them made in a country that you can't have access to during a time of crisis. That crisis is upon us. The National Federal Reserve Bank, which is an independent body, has lowered the rate. Why? Unemployment is on the way up. Unemployment in Massachusetts is higher than the national average. Tariffs are not going to be a solution. And watch the debt. Congress very soon will need to raise the debt ceiling. I don't know if there are still at least four or five Republicans that really won't vote to raise the debt ceiling, probably including Ron Paul, who ran for president. Ron is a strong believer in having a debt ceiling. We need it. We need a debt ceiling. We need to cut back. But Trump, you know, given all the cutting of employees, you know, giving all the layoffs, getting rid of all whatever, he's spending money faster in other areas, okay, that really haven't come to light. We do not need to have a tariff war, which is only going to hurt you and I by a national sales tax. Well, let me, I guess, make a couple of quick comments about Washington, D.C. I believe in the power of the police and law enforcement, and that we should have the best law enforcement that we can afford. And that makes sense. It does not make sense to be paying the National Guard to pick up trash off of U.S. monuments. In Washington, D.C., there are 9 judges that are vacant. The U.S. Senate, Trump could nominate 9 judges. The U.S. Senate could confirm them tomorrow, and that would help Washington, D.C. crime. Apparently, they are short on police, and I'm quite surprised to some degree. I didn't realize that police departments all over the country are having a recruiting problem. The city of Chicago needs 2,000 policemen. If I was Trump, I'd offer anyone in the military, if they want to be a Chicago policeman, a bonus to leave the military and become a Chicago policeman. What we need in Chicago and need in Washington, D.C. is to have a full police force. We don't need, Republicans to pass money to have emotionally disturbed individuals, primarily men, between the age of 16 and 39, screened or tested or helped. And then, as part of not having serious gun reform, and then Trump comes in and cuts that budget. So that money somewhat disappears. The cost of the National Guard, right? How many policemen would that money turn into if you hire policemen and train them? Now, I'm under impression it takes 6 months, a year to train policemen. I'm not sure why it takes that long, but apparently it does. And what Washington, D.C. needs is more judges, more policemen. Now, I understand there is a great cooperation between the FBI, a couple of the other law enforcement agencies are working at night with the local Washington Police Department and being out on the street or actively solving crimes that are particularly happening in neighborhoods or at night. I applaud that. I applaud them working together. But what does disturb me is ICE. It takes about 12 men, it looks like, to arrest one ICE person. And what they're doing is they're taking local police, they're taking FBI agents, they're taking the gun offices and the people that track down people that have escaped from jail. I forget what you call them. But they have taken from other federal police departments agents and manpower to boost up ICE. ICE now is the largest legal law enforcement unit in the United States. ICE. ICE, when it does its job of arresting criminals, of arresting people that aren't here on a legal basis and have caused some civil disturbances, caused problems, But when ICE goes after high school students who have been here since they were two, ICE goes after 80-year-old women, okay, who have been here 70 years, you know, every 20 years, the Congress, in its wisdom, has granted exemptions for citizenship to those that have been here 20 years. You know, they could have stopped that a long time ago by having an effective I-9 form. An I-9 form is a form that you got to fill out for an employer saying that you have a green card or that you're a U.S. citizen. But they've always left loopholes. And there probably still are loopholes in the I-9 form, okay? That form needs to be strengthened, okay? So that those that are not here legally, okay, are identified. Please hear me, though. If we've had people here in this country for 10 years, they've had children, those children are U.S. citizens. Clearly, the Constitution recognizes them as U.S. citizens. We need to be reasonable in who we're deporting. Cape Cod, always when I was growing up and in my working years, pleaded with the U.S. government to have people come from Jamaica or the Caribbean, okay, to be work in hotels, change the bed, be housekeepers, to work as bartenders, to work on the Cape. The Cape never had enough resources and people to come to the Cape to work on the Cape. They needed imports. It's apple season. Up in Hudson, Mass, I had an uncle that worked on an apple farm. He was in charge of it. And one summer there was a polio epidemic. And for 2 weeks the Boston schools were closed. And I worked on an apple farm. Where did the people come from? They came from Dominican Republic. They came from the Caribbean. They came up as an ethnic group. They picked apples for the season on that farm and then went on to another farm. They had their own housing on the farm. They had their own cooks on the farm. They had, on Saturday night, they overtook a bar in downtown Hudson and had their own bar. So there's a way in immigration that, yes, let's get more Palestinians in. Let's get more people from, you know, South America. Let's get more people from, you know, the Sudan. Let's get more people from Palestine. You know, let's get more people that we don't have already in the country to make it that diverse. But work for that diversity. One of the most wonderful things I've said before, and I'll say again, I went to Boston English High School. Where a third probably was Roman Catholic, a third was Jewish, and a third was African American, and a few WASP like me snuck in. And so diversity was a practical everyday occurrence in that school system. It was all men, and it taught me a lot about diversity. And in my ability to hire, I always practiced that. Well, I'm getting off the subject. Excise tariffs do not bode well for the future of this country. Well, I will go on to one local issue. I've been an advocate for a while of flying the Olympic flag under the Franklin flag here in the town of Franklin. And here is a letter that I have given to Jamie Helen, the town administrator. Dear Jamie Helen, I am requesting that the Olympic flag or the American Olympic flag be flown during the Winter Olympic Games from February 6th through February 22nd, 2026. In past years, we have had citizens of Franklin participate in both winter and summer Olympics. Some of these folks have won medals as recently as 2024 and have been honored on the Franklin Common. They have brought honor, recognition, character to the town of Franklin. It seems only right that in honor of our country's 250th anniversary, that we would make this part of our town's celebration. Peace and grace, Frank Edward Falvey. I would encourage you and hope you would similarly speak to town councilors, to the administration. I think it would be a great time of celebrating our 250th anniversary as part of it, and it would be a great honor for those that have come from Franklin and participated in the Olympics. And it would be a great honor for Franklin to show that we are a community diverse in ability and diverse in recognition of those who have brought honor to Franklin. Well, you know, you can always come in, see Pete or Chris, do your own program. They will more than help you. So think about it. Until I have another person to interview, which I hope will be a number of people running for town election, or I have something on my mind that I need to speak about. Good health, good living, peace and grace to you.
This program was made possible by your Franklin friends and neighbors, good folks just like you. Thanks for supporting Franklin TV. And thanks for watching.